without humility, there is no learning, right? You cannot learn and you cannot admit error without humility. And if you can't admit error, then you can't grow and you'll eventually engage in dangerous practices. If you as instructors do not model humility, your students will never admit mistakes. In fact, they'll hide mistakes and so they won't learn.
Firehouse Vigilance presents the Weekly Scrap, a podcast dedicated to the never-ending fight against complacency.
Corley Moore, Firehouse Vigilance, it is Weekly Scrap number 242. Tonight's guest is Ian Bennett. He has been in the fire service since 2006 for Seattle Fire Department. He has taught for the Washington State Fire Training Academy, taught at Seattle Fire's Recruit School, was involved with SFD's Acquired Structure Live Fire Program. He was instrumental in developing what would be the foundation for West Coast Fire Training and also the SFD's Live Fire Training Curriculum. In 2018, he started West Coast Fire Training to help other departments improve their live fire training. He has helped several departments in his area start their own Acquired Structure Live Fire Training programs. At this point, Ian has been involved in close to 70 different Acquired Structure burns. He is involved with NFPA 1400, which of course includes 1403. He loves being a firefighter. He loves training. He loves teaching people how to train effectively. He also has an amazing family that has let him pursue his passion for the fire service and live fire training. It is my absolute pleasure to have him on as the guest of Scrap number 242. Welcome, my brother, Ian Bennett.
What's up, Curly?
Man, I'm excited. I'm excited about the topics. I'm excited to have you here. It's been long in coming and it's been too long, but I'm glad you're finally here.
Well, me too. I'm humbled to be here considering a lot of the guests you've had already. But love talking live fire training with anybody who will listen.
Well, you got a bunch of people already logging in that will listen and we're excited about talking about live fire training. Is there anything in the intro that I missed? Anything that you would like to add?
No, that's good.
Beautiful. Let's talk about those beautiful sponsors so we can get to that beautiful training talk. The OG sponsor of the Scrap is Kehose. Check them out online at kehose.com and follow them on Facebook. Affordable Drill Towers, on a mission to bring you cost-effective and versatile training props, like the Affordable Bailout Prop, which allows you to practice window bailouts, and ladder high point rescues. Also, they make the Affordable Standpipe Prop, which you can roll into your classroom for standpipe theory and then roll it into the parking lot and pump realistic flows and pressures. And of course, their mainstay, the Affordable Drill Tower. It comes in several configurations and comes standard with a standpipe system. Choose from one or two sets of stairs integrated into your existing Connex boxes for multi-story access or freestanding on a slab. All models are NFPA 1402 compliant and gain you ISO credit. The only thing that you can't do on an Affordable Drill Tower is live fire training. Call Steve, 844-55-TOWER, or drop an email to info@affordabledrilltowers.com. And last but not least, FirestationFurniture.com provides a complete line of quality furniture for your firehouse. Firefighter owned and operated, they understand the strain firefighters put on furniture and offer furniture that's built to last. Visit www.firestationfurniture.com for more information. And with that, we are through the sponsors and we are ready to scrap. So let me get you caught up to speed. I'm going to pull this up here 1 second while I work a computer. Not one of my strengths, as I'm well known. There we go. Cody Brooks says, on shift, checking in from Florida. There's an LFG. People are chiming in. They are checking in on Instagram. If you have questions for Ian, if you have questions for myself, Kyle Romagus is in the chats. He is monitoring the chats. He is grabbing your questions. So if you have them, please post them. And we will throw them at Ian, especially around live fire, 1403, or training. Those are the things we're really going to attack tonight. So, Ian, are you ready?
I'm ready. What's up, Kyle? Glad to see you there.
Awesome. There we go. Coming at you with the first topic, what is the true purpose of most live fire? What is the true purpose that most live fire training should be?
Thanks for starting with this. I think when we're doing live fire training, a lot of the problems that we run into come from not having a clearly defined mission that we're trying to accomplish with live fire training. It's just that we tend to view it as the place where we throw all the skill sets together. Okay, you spent all this time. Okay, let's just get a bunch of stuff all done at once. And we're missing the fact that people don't actually spend a lot of time in the live fire environment. I mean, if you look at your average department, how many fires they go to every year, it's not that many. And if you think about all the different positions that are occupied at each fire response, how many times did you actually get to flow from the nozzle at a fire? How many times did you actually get to do a VES? So the amount that we're learning about the wide variety of skill sets that we have as firefighters by going to fires, it can be sometimes very small. It's totally unique, valuable training that you get at real fires. There's stuff you can't experience anywhere else.
Right.
But the true purpose of live fire training is, number one, it's what we at West Coast Fire Training call normalization of the live fire environment, right? The live fire environment, the inside of a burning building, is like nothing else in the human experience, right? There's no corollary to it. There's nothing else that you can do in normal life that's going to get you ready for the inside of a burning building. And so we just need to give people time to be inside a burning building with a realistic fire so that they can experience heat. They can see how smoke, flame, and heat travel based on the vent profile and how those conditions change based on our fire ground actions of extinguishment, moving around, just from room to room. Simple things like the fact that heat banks down differently from room to room based on header sizes and how much a door is open or whether or not there's a door closed.
Nice.
People just need time to experience that stuff. And we rush past that. So we need to spend time just normalizing the live fire environment. That's why in our training, we spend a lot of time with guys just in what we call observation groups, where basically their whole role is to just move around, no tasks involved, so they can actually focus on what's happening while the fire is burning. Second thing, after normalization of the live fire environment, is building cues and context for the skills that you already have, right? So you get somebody fresh out of the recruit academy and they go to a fire. Most of the time they do something wrong. And you ask them, well, how come you didn't flow water here? Or how come you open that door or didn't open that door? They're like, well, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to. Well, we taught you to do that in recruit school. But the problem is they don't actually have a slide that goes with that skill set, right? It's in like saying, so it's like saying, okay, we're going to teach you how to box. I love combat sports, so we'll use a lot of fighting analogies.
Okay,
We're going to teach you how to box, right? So we're going to hit the heavy bag a lot. Well, you can learn a lot of good things hitting the heavy bag, but you're not going to be able to react when someone throws a punch at you because you've never actually had to read the other human's body movements. Right?
No.
And it's the same in the live fire environment, right? We need to generate a visual or heat or a sound cue that tells people, okay, now it's time to open the line. Or how many times have you told a new guy, oh, you should have flowed water there, or you shouldn't have flowed water there? Well, it's because they've never seen that condition before. So they have they're just guessing, right? They have a skill set, but they're just guessing when to apply it. So live fire training is for building those cues that say, okay, you see this amount of fire, you see this amount of smoke, that means you need to flow water and you can move them through that environment back and forth. So, okay, you see the smoke condition at the front door. Now we're going to move inside to room number one. You can feel a heat level, see a smoke level, move to the next room. Okay, now you can see rollover over your head. Okay, let's back up. And so they can tie visual and heat conditions as they move through the environment to a decision tree that they've already been taught.
Right.
And most live fire training isn't doing that. It's just go. Okay, you're on scene, find the fire, put it out. And then we'll yell at you later about how you messed it up.
So is it the building of the neural connections between the separate tasks in the environment, like the associative phase, basically?
Yeah. Yes, 100%. That's our second most important thing. And the third most important thing is we're trying to build confidence in people. Right. When you have folks who have 500 gallons of water in there and four people on their engine and they don't make entry, why is that? Well, they say it's because it's unsafe, but it's unsafe because they don't know what's happening inside. Right. When you take them inside and then you make them comfortable in the environment, right, because they just hang out in there and they move through it and they're They know how it's going to change from room to room based on the fire conditions. And then they know how and when to apply their skill sets of search or vent or extinguishment based on the conditions that happen from room to room or space to space. Suddenly their confidence goes through the roof. I mean, this, I'll give you a quick story. So we did, you know, the first set of acquired structure burns that kind of led to the formation of West Coast Fire Training. We did 3 days worth of live fire up in Whatcom County, District 7. Last day, we get one shift, and it's kind of, they're not the most confident, right? And we go through, we focus on all the things I just mentioned, and we do the last burn, which is the biggest burn. And after it's all over, one of the lieutenants comes out, and he's like, hey, man, I just wanted to say thanks. Up until today, that fire that you just had us go in on, that would have been an exterior attack first, right out of the gate.
Wow.
Right. But now I feel comfortable sending my tailboarder through the front door, making that left-hand turn and flowing and moving down the hallway to the bedroom. And what had changed? Well, essentially nothing. Equipment hadn't changed. Skill set hadn't changed. Right. Response time hadn't changed, but everything had changed because they understood what was going to happen in the environment based on the fire presentation. They understood when and how to use their skills in that specific environment. That's the other piece with the cues and context, right? Sometimes we learn a skill set, like flowing and moving is the most common one, and we do it either in a parking lot or we do it in the hallway. But we don't understand when we're new how to alter that skill set based on the specific environment that we're in. So we make common mistakes, right? How many times when people are new and they're flowing water, flowing and moving, and you black them out, do they get literally this close to a wall flowing and you can hear the roaring of the hose stream pounding against the wall?
Pounding.
Yeah. And it's because they don't know what that means.
Right.
Right. They've only ever flowed it right, either outside or in the hallway. And so they have no context for what that sound means to them and how to use that to change their behavior in the environment. And they don't have confidence to shut the line down because they've never been in that environment before. So if we can give them all those things, then suddenly everything gets easier. So
I love it. Just context. It really is building context.
Yeah, it's normalizing the live fire environment because we just don't spend a lot of time. And most of the time, if you just learn through experience, right, there's stuff on the line, right? You got to move fast. I don't have time to take Colin, my probie, right now into an actual house fire and say, hey, let's just hang out here for a sec.
Right.
Yeah, look down. Let's take a look around. Let's let this thing grow for another 30 seconds. See it travel around the door a little bit more. No, I mean, because that's 30 seconds that a victim might not have.
Right.
Right. Or that's 30 seconds of their stuff getting more burned up, which, and so I just can't do that from a moral standpoint, but I can create all those conditions in training over and over and over again to reinforce the things I want him to do.
Just to build the Rolodex as best as, I mean, obviously nothing builds it as good as experience, but we just don't have the sheer amount of reps that is possible to make it happen in the real world.
Yeah. And that's the other piece though. A lot of those things I just said, those three things that I just said, don't make sense when your vision of live fire training is the campfire in the corner.
Right.
Right. So we affectionately refer to, you know, like the 4 to 6 pallet fire in the Connex box or the fixed facility as the campfire in the corner.
Right.
Because that's what it is, right? It's just a big flame. It bounces off the ceiling a little bit. There's a little bit of smoke, maybe a fair amount if you've got some smoke barrels going. But people often don't understand the fuel loads necessary or how to alter vent profiles to create conditions in a fixed facility that more realistically mimic real conditions.
Right.
And it's not hard to do. I mean, I could show you in probably a day how to do it, but you have to have the underlying skill set of how to generate those conditions without frying yourself as the instructor or frying your students, right? That's why later on, and I mentioned we need to talk about common instructor errors.
Right, right.
But at the last fixed facility burns we did in early February, I mean, we had a 40-foot Connex box. Like it's 3 Connex box system, you know, 2 40-foot Connexes next to each other like this, and then one at the end, which is the burn cell. And we had rollover traveling 20 feet down both Connex boxes, zero visibility conditions from the front door to the back. You know, I mean, you can generate these conditions. You just have to know how to do it. Nice. And you have to have facility managers that will allow you to do it.
Allow you to generate that flame and that heat.
That goes to selling the program and how you build over time. It's like, yeah, that's a whole process.
Okay. John Shackelford has the first question coming at you from the audience. Are you ready for your first question?
Let's do it.
He says, what is the best, because we're on this topic, what is the best fuel package you have found for Connex burn buildings, pallets or OSB?
It's a combination. Pallets are a great base fuel because they're bigger, they're thicker, they'll sustain the burn longer, right? If you just use OSB, it's hard to get a base fuel or a base fire that's large enough to get the suspended OSB fuels going. So generally, it's what we call the stack, which is pallets with probably some scrap OSB sheeting in the top half of the stack, and then suspended OSB sheets on the upper walls and in chains. I think that's a pretty common setup in a lot of steel Connex facilities.
Right.
But OSB is great.
Love it. Jay Obbs wants to know, what training do you recommend for small companies, i.e. two, maybe three on an engine?
When we're talking about those main goals that I mentioned earlier, the training doesn't change based on company size, right? Because once you make the choice to make entry, you're going to the nozzle or the search team, they're going to encounter and have to deal and make choices in those conditions, regardless of your staffing level.
Okay.
Right. And so the needs of a two-person company in terms of being able to recognize conditions are the same as the needs of, you know, a metropolitan department my size. Again, the piece where people, I think, where we have gone wrong in the history of live fire training is that we treat live fire training as operations drills, is like we drill fire responses. Right. When really what a fire response is a coordination drill. Right. If I want, and that's important, right, as a department that throws a lot of people at a single family residence fire, we need to coordinate those operations well if we want to be as efficient and as effective as possible. And so we need to practice that in live conditions, or not live conditions, but, you know, in real time. Right. Hey, engine one arrives, you deploy, engine two, truck one, all that stuff. The mistake we make is that we add live fire to that, and we don't need to add live fire to that. And in fact, most of the time we shouldn't add live fire to that, because it distracts from the coordination drill and it makes the live fire portion much more dangerous. Right. When we do these big freeform drills where people respond in, the ability to control the live fire conditions and account for possible errors or uncontrolled fire conditions gets much, much harder. And the other thing is that the learning value for anyone who's not on the nozzle or the search team goes way down.
Right.
Right. Because you might as well be doing those things with a hood over your face, right, once you go inside. So that's why when we do our live fire training, we don't focus on response orders or operations. It's single skill sets, right? Extinguishment. Right. We're going to start with the charge line here in the living room, and you're going to flow and move down the hallway to the bathroom. That's it. Or up the stairs to the bedroom on floor two. That's it. All that other stuff, like dry stretching, pumping, all that stuff can be drilled without live fire. And it should be drilled without live fire most of the time. Occasionally, it's nice to work in live fire just as a kind of a reward for the guys, but that shouldn't be the main focus of your live fire training, because it's just live fire training is dangerous. It's dirty. It's really expensive. It takes a long time. And so you want to get the maximum value out of it. And the maximum value is getting it as realistic as possible and putting people in there as much as possible, as long as possible, so that you can work on those skills and those recognition education pieces that you can only do with live fire.
Right.
Right.
So I love this question coming at you. This one's coming from Instagram. It's coming from Caleb McLaughlin, which has been a long time since I've seen you, Caleb. It's been a whopping 3 or 4 days. But he asks, what's the best way to train if you don't have a burn facility close, which ties right into what you're saying?
To prep yourself for live fire, if you don't have a burn facility, in that case, what we do often is YouTube firefighting, right? So you can still do some stuff with cues and context with online videos, right? Because now interior footage is really good with the proliferation of helmet cameras and recording ticks. You can really show people some stuff. You can't drill the heat. You know, you can't drill the sound or the feel in the same way that you can in a burn building. But that's what we do. And we do that on shift, every shift. That's part of our morning roll call. You know, just right. you watch a couple of fires in the morning and you talk about, okay, which line are we going to lay? Where are we going to lay it? Once you get inside, what conditions do you expect to face? Which direction are you going to turn, left or right? You know, how soon would you expect to flow water? Where would you expect to go if you're on the truck? You know, do we think the room is open? That's what you're going to have to do. But to drill those other things, like getting confident in heat, I mean, that's like, you just can't do it without heat. It's like, how do you learn to swim? Like, you eventually got to get in the water.
Right. Right. No, great answer. Great question. Thank you for sending it. Let me pull it up here. Eventually. Whoop, whoop, whoop. Coming at you. Kyle's grabbing them. Thank you for the question, John. Thank you for the question. James Michalisco. Ian, is the NFPA still trying to outlaw OSB as a Class A material?
Been waiting for this question. I thought it would come up sooner. No. And I can speak directly to that. So anybody who might have missed it in the intro, I'm on the NFPA committee. I'm an alternate voting member under Brian Brush. We just met for the upcoming revision to 1400, which includes 1403. We met back in February in Florida. There was a long discussion about this. We are not trying to ban OSB. In fact, the committee is... I can't say we're going in the other direction, but we're intentionally preserving OSB. And if for anyone who's interested, do you want me to dive into the details on that discussion?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyone who's read the UL research on this stuff, what they show you is that any fuel in a vent limited condition generates smoke that is toxic. Okay. Doesn't matter if it's pallets, doesn't matter if it's hay, doesn't matter if it's wood, OSB, it all generates toxic byproducts because it's incomplete combustion. It's just which toxic byproducts do you want, right? Some produce more hydrogen cyanide, some produce more other benzene, some produce other more nasty stuff. And when you actually look at the statistics and the error bars of OSB versus pallets, they're within the same error bars, right? OSB okay. might be like a tiny percentage worse than pallets, but it's so close that honestly, if what you're going to say is that we need to ban OSB because of the cancer risk that it creates for firefighters, then the only moral choice that you can make is you have to ban all Class A fuels and just go to gas prompts, right? That's right. The only, and there's an interesting discussion about risk mitigation that actually comes from OSHA. There's lots of ways to mitigate risk. And the first one is you can eliminate. But the thing is, there's no substitute for Class A fuels, right? Gas props and fake smoke just do not generate conditions that mimic close enough interior firefighting, right? You cannot, it's our belief, it's my belief that with current technology, we cannot effectively prepare people with gas props alone.
Right on.
That you have to use Class A fuels. Now, you can do a lot of, I mean, I've been able to do great fires with just pallets and hay. OSB is great. It's very convenient, but it's not 100% necessary. But yeah, you got to have Class A fuels. And so that's why it's sticking around.
Love it. And Brian Brush just chimed in and said, no greater partners on the side of live fire training in the NFPA right now. And I said it wrong. I'm sorry. Brian Crush just chimed in. So I had to get it right.
What's up, Brian? Love that guy.
Everybody does, man. One of the best. Absolutely one of the best. David Pruitt says, I love the coordination aspect. Can you talk about your process to vet participants before they are allowed to get into live fire?
Yeah. So this is a key point. And when you look at the history of the line of duty deaths and close calls around live fire training, you see this come up a lot. We often ask people to do things in live fire training that they are not prepared to do. And when I say prepared, I don't mean like they're not like mentally ready. Like they literally don't have the skills to do it. Right. And so when we do our training, especially when we do open classes where we don't know the participant's skill level, we literally do a skills test at the beginning of day one. And depending on their level of skill at certain tasks, they don't get to do certain things. And that's for their safety and for ours, right? So if we're going to create if somebody cannot, say, flow and move effectively and manipulate the line and the pattern and the stream where it needs to go accurately, they just don't get to be on the nozzle. And like, I have no qualms about that, because it means if you can't do that, that means we can't generate certain fire conditions safely. Right. And it's the same thing. Like if you don't have, I need to know if you have the athleticism. Like one of the tests we do is, hey, everybody put on all your gear and then kneel down and stand up 10 times in a row.
Right.
That's it. Because how many times have you gone to a training and, you know, the dude with the bad knee or the dude who's 75 pounds overweight, like you say, okay, it's time to move. And you know, that's a process, right? it's a thing that's going to take a minute. And right. That doesn't mean we're not going to put you inside, but that's something we need to account for when we move you around in the building, because I mean, we're going to start you as close to the fire as we possibly can, because we want you to see the growth. But then you're going to move back from room to room to room. And then we might have you move forward again from room to room. And if you're that guy who's, you know, a 60-year-old volunteer who's a little overweight and two bad knees, well, there's some things you might not see. And it's nothing personal. It's just that we can't put you in a position where you're going to be unsafe. And that's one of the things, once you start to generate more realistic conditions, you have to be honest with people. And about their skill sets and what that means for their ability to perform.
Love it. Love it. I absolutely do. Josh Everett chiming in, said South Texas iPhone boy here. Yeah. Proud of that, man. I love it. Kyle Romagus is asking you a question. Ian, my brother, what are some of the common mistakes you have seen from nozzlemen that move from the parking lot or drill towers into the acquired structure burns?
Okay. So the first one that we see is, guys, one, they advance too close to the fire before they open the line. So this is especially true when people they're not familiar with limited visibility conditions, right? Because what you realize once you spend some time inside these buildings is that the fire builds up, you see rollover form, and then actually rollover goes away because the whole place gets vent limited, right? The smoke builds up, and so the heat's there, but you can't see the fire anymore. And we're such visual creatures that until people have gotten it into their heads that the heat's there, but I can't see fire anymore, they'll proceed way too far forward before opening the line. And so that's just something you got to teach them. Then the thing that we see is they advance too fast, right? You're used to being able to just sprint forward when you're flowing in a hallway. But once you put, you know, super high heat, you know, 1500 degrees at the ceiling, 800 degrees waist level, you need time to cool that space effectively before you should move into it. And this is especially true. It's less true in hallways, because hallways are very forgiving because they're small. But when you go into a big room, like say you move from the kitchen into the living room, and it's a 900 square foot living room, and we've had fire in that living room down to the like chest level all throughout the living room, you'll have guys just cram themselves in there, and they won't hit those gases off to their left and right, and they'll have fire wrapping back around behind them. They need to move inside, just chill, you know, and then let the water do the work, let the stream reach out and cool those spaces. So moving too far forward, moving too fast forward once they're flowing water. And then the other big one is people struggle when it's not a hallway. So at least in a lot of places, you know, you have houses that are room to room to room. There's no hallway, right? That making sense?
No. And so yes.
In a hallway, right, the stream, you can do this in the stream real easily because the hallway confines the water for you, right? And even if you're not super accurate, it's just going to travel the walls and the ceiling and just cool all that stuff, even if you're not very good. But when you go big room to doorway to big room again, guys will cool the room, but then they're looking for those walls. They want that audio feedback of the right. Whack, 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 whack on the walls and the ceiling. And so they never put water through the doorway. So you'll have fire just pump or hot gas is just pumping through that doorway, but they're not cooling anything. So then they start to get to a bunch of steam because the water falls down, breaks up on the walls, but it's not cooling anything. So you just got this jet of fire and hot gas is just blowing all this steam back on them. They're like, what? This thing doesn't work. Well, you're not putting water in the right place. So they don't cool the room and then narrow the stream up to seal the next space. I mean, Fields is right. It's like you got to use the reach, then you got to coat, but then the last one is you got to seal that next space.
Seal.
And if you're not sealing it, then, and it's easy to seal in a hallway, but room to room, it's harder. It takes a higher level of skill.
No, and even Kyle said hallways are a pickup game, like bowling with the rails up.
Yeah.
Love
yeah,
it.
So.
I had a question coming at you from Instagram. I wanted to see it real quick. Grateful Dad said, GR8 Full Dad, when will the next West Coast Fire Training live fire be, and can I help load pallets?
Okay, the line out the door to help load pallets is pretty long at this point. I'm sorry, my brother, probably not. When is the next one? That is a good question. The next one that's firmly on the books is going to be in October with that Brian Brush's facility out there. Nice. In Midwest City. So we were hoping to do the PNW conference out here in an acquired structure, but we couldn't line up a building, so didn't.
And well, I'll look forward to seeing you when you come back down here to Midwest City, because that's right in my neck of the woods. So
yeah.
I just got to be in state when you're in my state.
right. And if anybody wants to invite us out to their place, right, we're happy to travel.
Always. Kyle Romagus is coming at you again, because I love his questions, man. He just sends great questions at you.
Yeah, but, Kyle's a deep thinker.
What are some tips for making an acquired structure last during live burns? Are there some essential tactics people can use to prep the structure that you would recommend?
My question back to Kyle, and since he's in the chat, maybe you can ask, what do you mean by last, right? Because do you mean 6 days? Do you mean 2 days? Do you mean till the end of one day, right? Because those different levels are require very different prep. Now, if you want it to last just one day, you don't have to do much. What you have to do is not burn too long in any one room. And then once that room is done, it's best to seal it up.
Okay.
Right.
Because what take it out of the equation. Take it out of the equation.
Yeah, because what people will do is that room's all it's all destroyed anyway. It's you're not like you want to seal stuff in there. And usually part of the ceiling will fail if you're just doing one day burns and you don't do any reinforcement. And so then fire can travel into the attic and that's bad. And plus it also lets smoke out of the normal pathways. And so the fire behavior doesn't act like you expect. The main problem I think it often has less to do with reinforcement, especially if you're doing one day burns, and it has to do with people not understanding how to control the vent profile. And so they burn too long in a room. And so then it gets into the void spaces right away.
Right.
And then once it gets into the void spaces, they don't know what to do. It's funny. I've run into this a couple of times where it'll get into the void spaces and people kind of look like, oh God, like it's in the attic. What do we do now? It's like, let me ask you a question. So what would you do if it was in the attic at a real fire?
At a real fire.
Oh, I'd throw a ladder up there and I'd dig it out.
Right.
Yeah. That's what we're going to do right now. it's going to be okay. But if it's just a smoldering void space fire, it's easy. Now, if you want to go longer, you know, if you want to burn more than once
he,
in the same room.
He clarified just so I give you context. Couple of days, tricks to keep the fire from going north. There you go.
Yeah. So you got to reinforce the ceiling, right? Anywhere there's going to be direct flame impingement, and especially direct flame impingement and water application, you got to put basically either plywood or OSB sheeting up, right? And it, like, extra sheets of sheetrock, don't waste your time. That's just going to fall down, right? It's just going to get wet. It's going to get hot, and then it's going to get wet, and it's going to disintegrate. The best solution is just put a, like, literally cover the whole ceiling with a layer of OSB. Then you burn once, and then if you want to burn again, you just tack more OSB on top of the charred OSB that you got there, right? It's a fresh layer, so it'll burn again. It'll keep the bottom layer from burning off, and you don't have to search for studs anymore, because you just have a solid layer of OSB underneath. Same in hallways, just any ceiling area that's going to take any significant, especially water application.
Right.
And then if you're going to burn like real heavy in a room or anywhere, you're going to have the burn stack right up in a corner. It's best to like throw a couple of OSB sheets on the upper walls, right where you're going to have direct flame impingement from the stack itself. But other than that, that's about it. Just cover your penetrations, and yeah, that's the main thing. And then don't be lazy about like getting into the room and pulling stuff out, right? The reset, like there's got to be a team, either the attack team or the safety line or whoever has got to go in there and pull that burn stuff out. I mean, they don't have to like shovel it out, but you got to pull the big stuff out so you don't have a fire going in there, or, you know, and you got to inspect the ceiling. But yeah, solid sheets. Don't waste your time with sheetrock.
Jake Jorgensen following up said, would you recommend the ceiling be reinforced with plywood and layers of sheetrock, or just a couple layers of sheetrock?
No sheetrock. Don't waste your time with sheetrock. Just plywood or OSB.
Nice. Okay.
Like a single layer of plywood or OSB, standard thickness. Thicker sheets will last longer. Plywood will last generally a little bit longer than OSB. But if you're doing the vent profile and your ignition sequence correctly, your burn shouldn't last longer than 5 to 8 minutes. And so your OSB is not really going to disintegrate completely.
Love it. There's your answer. Great question.
Yeah. We used to do the layering of sheetrock and OSB, sheetrock and OSB. But what we found is the sheetrock just falls apart. And then you'd kind of burn through the OSB a little bit, and then you end up pulling like multiple layers. It's a giant pain in the ass.
Right.
So just a single layer, and then relayer over that.
Okay.
Because you actually have easier access. If it burns all the way through and gets into the attic a little bit, you can see where it's happening. So.
Love it. Too many questions coming at you. I want to get to Brian's, but also there's a couple that are kind of in the same realm. Basically, in your opinion, this one comes from James Michalisco up out of Indiana. In your opinion, what are some changes that can be added or eliminated from 1403? So I know we're going to get to 1403, so I didn't know if you want to address it here and talk about what's coming, or do you want to keep going with you tell me which way you want to go with it.
Whenever we choose to address 1403, let's just do it all at once and then get that out of the way.
Okay, then we'll get your 1403 questions in, because there's a few of them that are kind of in that realm. So we'll get those at the end. I'll go back to instructing in live fire burns and go to Brian Crush. He said, aside from the technical parts of burns, Ian, can you explain your process for instructional humility and awareness in a post action review?
So you probably noticed on our website, our number one value at West Coast Fire Training is humility, right? Without humility, there is no learning, right? You cannot learn, and you cannot admit error without humility. And if you can't admit error, then you can't grow, and you'll eventually engage in dangerous practices. And that has to be, and students, if you as instructors do not model humility, your students will never admit mistakes. In fact, they'll hide mistakes, and so they won't learn, or they won't learn as fast, right? I mean, we're pretty good at that in my department right now, but we used to be terrible about it, and we used to have these company drills, and we would all meet at our training facility in the pavilion, and, you know, those of us who are the instructors used to call it the pavilion of lies, because everyone would go there. It's like, hey, how'd the drill go? Lieutenant, oh, great. Oh, you were first in on the nozzle. How'd it go? Perfect. Yeah. No changes. Right.
Right.
And that's because we had a culture that wasn't humble, and we couldn't admit mistakes, because once you people, I mean, this is pretty basic stuff, but people have to feel safe admitting error. And what we have, I think what Brian's probably driving at is that we have to recognize that live fire training is training, right? Training is where we make mistakes so that we can learn, right? It's not a performance test, right? Nice. And so your guys have to be feel safe making mistakes and admitting ignorance. Otherwise, they'll never learn, right? And that's critical for long-term safety. And we can get in more into this later, but you know, there's a lot of like PhD level research into organizations that are able to do high risk activities for long periods of time without catastrophic failure. And one of the critical components of that is, they call it something different, but it's essentially humility, right? You have to be able to learn from your mistakes, recognize your errors, and we as instructors have to model that, right? And I'll give you a couple of examples. Like whenever we teach our train the trainer class, after the basically the introductions, the first thing I show is one of the first burns that I was in charge of as the instructor in charge. I essentially almost killed myself and 15 students.
Wow.
Right. There was it was a single point failure event. Like nothing happened. And the crazy thing about it, Corley, is that except for me and one other guy who was there, nobody even knew what had happened. Right. Everyone else was just like, oh, that was kind of cool. Well, yeah, that was pretty hot. Well, yeah, that was awesome. Right, guys. And so we had to sit down and be like, hey, just so we're all on the same page, like that was this close, right? We almost had an event that could have changed live fire training in Washington State forever.
Right.
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 But not every close call ends up with injuries, gear damage, right? Sometimes it's just like, whew. And as an instructor, it's very easy to walk past those things, right? But you can't, you literally cannot walk past those things. You have to share them. I hope that's what Brian was driving at.
No, it's beautiful. Timestamp, boom, max points for this question already. Yeah, they absolutely crushed the answer, man. And I think that's what he was driving at. He was giving you the toss right down the middle so you could crush it.
Yeah, it's nice to have a plant in the audience.
And Smoothboard Cartel said, just so we're clear, we almost died. But no, it's part of it, man. It's beautiful, man, and the ability to make it. Jake Jorgensen said, I know you talked about identifying your skill set, but what do you do if a student makes it to a live burn and then shows sign of panic when they're in the IDLH?
So this has only happened one time. And then that relies on one of our main safety procedures is what we call instructor positioning, right? Panic only really matters that much if you're on the nozzle, right? Because the nozzle is the one who's going to be closest to the threat, right? And they're going to be the ones engaging with and making the push on the fire. And so we always have, the instructor always has to be in a position to experience heat at the same time or before the student does.
Okay.
Right. So that way, when the student either fails to engage correctly with the threat, the instructor can stop them, or they can literally take the nozzle from them. Or in the case of one student, the instructor had to grab the student and keep him from pulling his face piece off and escort him out. But usually you can figure out if that's going to be an issue. That incident was why we instituted the skills test at the beginning.
Right.
Because we kind of figured out early on when we watched this guy trying to put his gear on that he wasn't super confident, just not very familiar with his gear, right? And so when you have people do things like bunk up for time, go on air for time, move around in their gear, just like do a quick search crawl back and forth, flow water for a little bit, you get a really good feel real easily with someone's experience and comfort level, right? So... But the IDLH, it's instructor positioning, right? The instructor has to be in a position to literally control the student who's closest to the threat.
Love it. Looking here. Matt Coquill, how do you scale realistic and difficult trainings at work without chipping away at guys' confidence and making sure they leave with a successful, positive outcome while challenging them simultaneously?
Well, the first thing you should do is you have to tell guys what you're trying to do, right? This whole piece of normalizing the live fire environment, building cues and confidence, creating an educational environment, you have to tell people that you're going to do that, right? In my department now, we don't have to say that every time because it's part of our training culture now.
Right.
But especially if you're working with groups that you don't know, that is often not the case. You know, it's not super common that that's the training culture that people come from. So you have to just say right up front, like, hey, guys, this is what we're working on. So we're going to focus way less on performance. We're going to focus way more on you just spending time. And if you make mistakes, that's totally fine. Right. That's what we're here for. So you just have to clearly articulate all those things
right
up front. So then people know, like, it kind of takes the weight off their shoulders. Like, oof, all right, if I make a mistake, it's not going to be the end of the world. The instructor's not going to chew me out in front of everybody and make fun of me. Now, right. People are still going to feel bad.
Sure.
Right. You can't do much about that. But the next thing is you graduate training, right? You don't start off on the first burn with, you know, rollover traveling 30 feet in zero visibility conditions, right? You scale the training, right? You start off with a fire that's smaller. You start off with higher visibility conditions. And then, you know, so you start easy, right? It's just like, it's like lifting weights, right? You don't start off and be like, hey, you look like you're a pretty big guy. We're just going to throw three plates on both of this side and just rep out some bench, right? No, you just start with a bar. You make sure that people have good technique. And that's the skills test out front. And then you throw on some warm-up sets to make sure everyone's clear on what the procedures are and what we're doing here after you've explained it. And then you slowly build it up.
Right.
Right.
Beautiful, and beautiful analogy.
Yeah. And depending on people's skill sets, right, you can alter it up and down, right? So at our last fixed facility training, we had this group of three from a department that were highly, highly skilled. Like, they could have taught any of the stations that we were running. And so when we were doing our final sets of fire attacks, right, we threw some twists in for them. Like, we threw victims in the way of the hose line that nobody else had to deal with, because we knew they could handle it, right? We're not going to crush them. This is going to be a nice challenge. But that is the instructor. You just have to figure out where your student's skill set is, where their comfort level is, and either meet that or exceed it just a little bit.
Awesome. No, great question, Matt. Thank you for sending it. Another one coming at you from Kyle. In cases of rapid, I love this question, so I'm skipping to it. In cases of rapid fire development in a big room, there's a lot of misinformation and old war stories of full fog needing to be used for protection. With the amount of burns you have conducted, I'm positive you have had instances of rapid fire development in big rooms. What would you recommend the reaction to be from the nozzleman to shut down rapid fire development after it occurs in a big room? And by big room, he's saying 400 to 600 square foot living rooms, for example.
Yeah, open the line and keep it open and move it around. Like, open the line and go like this.
There you go.
All over the place. And it's funny, in that close call that I talked about, a small piece of that was me in a weird instructor. I got in this weird instructor versus survival mode. Right, I could see what was happening. I could see that the room was progressing to flashover, but I didn't want to put the fire out right away because I was like, oh man, we're going to end this training experience sooner than I wanted. We're not going to hit all the teaching points that I want. So I'm just going to see if I can knock back this thing a little bit. And we don't have time to pull up the video right now, but you could see me pencil. It just stirs the smoke layer up. Everything starts catching on fire even more. And then I was just like, okay, game on. Yeah, just open the line. Open the line, keep it open, move it around. That solves all your issues.
There you go. And Smooth War Cartel said, it sounds simple because it is.
Yeah. Yeah, don't play with it, right?
Right. No, I love it. I got a good – here's one, which you were involved in this, so I'm going to throw this one at you. What are your thoughts on the new HEN nozzle? And you can explain your experience with it.
So for anybody who doesn't know, HEN has run two acquired structure burns with multi-room fires, modern combustibles, and I was the instructor in charge and did the live fire plans and ran both of those days. HEN had been trying to capture video footage of the nozzle fighting acquired structure fires, but they had not been able to do that successfully. They had they tried. I've seen some of that footage. It's not very good. The fire behavior is not realistic. The temperatures are not realistic. And even the video footage is not well done because people just don't have that kind of experience. And thankfully, so they reached out to me to say, hey, could we do this? And so we consulted, did those burns, captured a lot of good footage, but I think I imagine a lot of people here have seen. And so my judgment on the nozzle is I think it's a good tool, right? I think it does what Dennis and Ray and Hen folks say it does. It is what it says it is, right? It's a flat blade. It's a smooth bore nozzle that has either a straight stream or a flat stream. If you want a much more detailed explanation, read the stuff from Dennis. It's all accurate, right? So especially what we've tested it in is the residential environment. And in the residential environment, it's more effective than a straight stream, right? Because it penetrates as effectively, but it covers surfaces faster and it cools gases faster because of the shape of the stream. Now, that's its scientific effectiveness, right? Now, whether or not you buy the nozzle is a whole different question, right? Because it's more expensive than a smooth bore. It's less expensive than a TFT Midmatic. And like budgetary concerns are real, right? We don't live in a magical world where you just say, hey, this is 10% better than the last thing, so we're just going to switch out to that now, right?
Right.
It's not like that. You got to make real choices with your real budgetary concerns. And the truth is, I mean, if you want a much more articulate version of what I'm about to say, just read Jay's article on Engine Company Resurrection, his opinion piece on the nozzle. But you know, if you're doing a nozzle study, like if you're in the market for a new nozzle and you're not considering the Hen, I feel like you're not doing your job. Right. You should consider the Hen. You should consider a straight smooth bore, and should consider your, you know, combination nozzle. But you know, if I had them, and if you have hose to support, you know, a smooth bore nozzle, like I would run it 100%. We don't run it in Seattle because we don't have the hose to support it. Right. I can't in good conscience tell my guys to run it because the hose will kink. Right. But it is what it says it is, right? And it does a great job. And I'm very curious to see how the Dennis's backflow pressure increaser, that thing's going to be magic.
The turbo?
Thing also works, right? It does what it says it does. At least, but the other thing too is like we've tested it in 10 different burns in the residential environment. It did really well under extreme conditions, but it's still a small test sample, right? So as the fire service, we have a tendency, like I like the nozzle, I would use it. It would be my preference to use it over any other options, but we have a history in the fire service of over applying small results, right? Just look at the first UL study on exterior water. Right. We found out exterior water wasn't the end of the world. And suddenly everybody says, oh, we must do exterior water all the time.
Right.
Right. We vastly over applied like a single result.
Right? Here comes slicers.
Yeah. We just got to take it for what we know. Don't over apply. Right. Should you test it out? Yeah. But that's where I'm at.
No, great answer. And we'll be even more on it because Dennis is coming on to talk about not just the Hen, but all of Dennis type things. He's coming on in a few, probably about a month, I believe, but maybe a little longer. I'll have to check.
And just so everyone knows, I'm not employed by Hen. They did pay me to run the burns because I don't work for free, but I'm not on their staff.
Right. You are not a paid...
spokesman.
Right, you're not a spokesman. That's the word I was looking for. I didn't want to say, yeah. Jake Dill said, I'm just curious why we go back to the turbo Hen when we still have a flow restriction in place. That's the main thing I've heard from a lot of people is there. I've always been saying, well, smooth bore is smooth. You can pass a obstruction. From what I understand, the turbo, which I'm very interested in the turbo, I think it's even more innovative than the Hen. You can make hose match a smooth bore that, you know, a lot of people, that's the major inconvenience.
You can pass a quarter or a rock like as thick around as my thumb through the turbo.
Right, through the turbo. Yeah, no, it's all, yeah, the turbo is what, like I said, I think that's the biggest game. I haven't messed with it, but just from observing and hearing people I respect talk about it, when you can get the back pressure to keep your low pressure, your high pressure hose working with a smoothbore 50 PSI flow, man, it's like the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I agree.
Massive innovation. Let's get to 1403. Let's talk about it. Where do you want to go with it? Because you're, yeah.
Well, why don't you just answer the questions that the audience has right now? Because I've got my opinions, but I'm here to answer their questions.
I like it. Let me pull it up here. In your opinion, what are some changes that can be added or eliminated from 1403?
Let's be clear. These are my opinions. I argued for some of these opinions, but some of them didn't get changed. So okay. take that for what it is, right? I'm just one member of the committee. I personally don't think we should have to rotate ignition officers after. I don't think we should have to rotate ignition officers. Now, I understand why and where that comes from. There's a line of duty death associated with it. And as the ignition officer, you're the most in danger of being overheated in fixed facilities. I think there are more appropriate ways to mitigate that risk than mandated rotation. Right. I think that authority having jurisdictions should be able to set other things in place. You know, there's core monitoring, there's heart rates, there's rehab procedures. There's a lot of other things that could maintain the safety of the ignition officer and allow and kind of reduce the logistical burden that that rotation requires. Right. And it also makes it harder to teach the next up and coming person. Right. If I have to rotate out every two times we did change it. So you don't have to rotate after every burn. It's going to be after every two burns now. So there's going to be a little more flexibility there. But I think people should be able to make their own choices about that. But I understand that in my organization, we're very proactive about people's health, and we have a culture of people not doing stupid things and overheating themselves.
Right.
That's a whole educational piece of how to protect yourself as the ignition officer. And we hold people accountable for that. But other places don't do that. So the other one is instructor two, right? Instructor two is about how to design lesson plans in the interior, like in the classroom, right? You should be able to run a live fire burn without having instructor two. I think you should have to have a different qualification. I think we just ended up using instructor one and instructor two for live fire training because we didn't have anything else that existed. I think it's a totally different skill set.
Nice. No, I love that. Now, is that a change that is coming, or is that one you would like to see?
That's one I would vote for, but it's not changing.
Okay. Okay. No, I wanted to be clear. So what changes do you see that are coming?
The biggest one is there's a much greater emphasis on decon procedures. We wanted to put that in because if we're going to say, hey, you can expose yourself to all this toxic stuff, we wanted to say like, hey, you should really be cleaning yourself up afterwards. Right? Don't be lazy about that. There's not actually a whole lot of dramatic changes to 1403 this time around. The increase in the amount, you know, only having to rotate after every two burns. There's some language changes. Keeping OSB, that's not a change, but we took out the language.
Something that will make a lot of people breathe a sigh of relief for sure.
Yeah, we took out the language that said you have to use organic hay. Now you can just use any hay or straw.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be organic because if you look into the details, like the ability to guarantee that something's organic is essentially, it's a fallacy, right? And hay, and same as with OSB, right? Hay is the only, or like straw is the only thing that does what that product does, right? So if you want to be able to create good smoke barrels or use it as a bridge fuel, it's the only thing. And so there's no effective substitute. So let's make it easier for people to use that so they don't have to.
No, I think you're covered. Jim Platt, this is kind of around that. As a training officer, Jim Platt wants to know, as a training officer, instructor, et cetera, how do you stay on top of all the NFPA, OSHA, ISO standards to make sure your live fire training is satisfying all the acronym cops out there, but keep the training fun, realistic, and allowing the students to grow?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, like 1403 is not that long and it's not that complicated. Same with 1001. Like most of the NFPA standards are not that long. They're not that complicated. And I don't feel like it's too much to ask to read them, right? They only change every 5 years, right? So like a lot of people in this audience are reading stuff to get better at the job. I don't feel like it's too much to ask to say like, yeah, just read these four standards. The total page volume might be like 150 pages at most. And none of it's not super complicated. The language can be a little technical. And then on that note about keeping it fun, I've never had a problem creating realistic live fire training conditions while being 1403 compliant. I've just never had that problem.
Okay.
The where people make the mistake is that they think that 1403 limits the fuel load. It doesn't limit the fuel load, right? You can use as much fuel as you want to achieve the training objective, but people don't have the experience. They don't have like the thing that's different about what we do at West Coast Fire Training is we have a system, right? There's a system that we use to train our people. And there's a system that we use to build fire. And there's a system that we use to train students. And so we know how to create the conditions that we want fairly consistently. I mean, especially in acquired structures, there's always a little bit of wiggle room. You can't guarantee conditions 100%. But so we have a system to create stuff. We're not guessing.
Right.
Right. And so when we can push and say, yeah, I mean, we want to create conditions that's flashover in the room of origin and heavy rollover in the hallway. And we have a way, we have a procedure to generate that. We have a procedure to create instructors who are qualified to teach in that environment, who are qualified to keep students safe in that environment. And we have an instructional methodology to get students ready to learn in that environment. Right. And that's all the stuff I'm talking about is it's getting people ready to be there. Right. The problem is people try and do all that stuff before they're ready.
Nice. Nice.
And it's one of the things I talk about in the in our train the trainer class is I think that live fire training is almost like an unrecognized technical discipline. Right. We think that because we're good at putting out fires, that means that we're good at generating live fire conditions and teaching in those conditions. And it's not true. It's totally different. Right. And you and I, Corley, I mean, maybe you would. I don't know your history, but I would never be comfortable going up on top of the Space Needle and just grabbing some rope bags and some harnesses and being like, hey, man, let's just dangle off this thing and have some fun. It's a beautiful summer day. Doesn't that sound great? You know, we would never be so arrogant to do that. But when we go to an acquired structure building and we're like, hey, you ever done an acquired structure fire yet? Oh, yeah. I remember we did that in recruit school like 15 years ago. Were you in charge? No, I was just learning. Okay. Do you think we can do some training in here? Yeah, it'll be fine.
Right. Right.
Think about the arrogance there.
Right.
Right. It blows my mind. I mean, that's why we're having problems is because people who have no like good intention people, right? They're trying to do the right thing, but they have no idea what they're doing.
Love it. All right.
I don't say that in a mean way. It's just
no, not at all. I think you encapsulated it very well when you talked about the arrogance to say that. And arrogance is very close to ignorance. I mean, very much so. All right. Here's what I'm going to throw at you is book or books that you think firefighters should be reading.
Yeah. So I struggled with this question. So I think I'm actually going to say something I think close to what Brian Crush said, which is I really don't care what books people are reading. You just have to read.
Yes.
Like, just read, because the collected wisdom, knowledge, and experience of the human race is contained in books, right? And if you're not in those books, what are you doing, right? You can be good at this job and never read a book. You can come into work every day, work hard, and you can be decent at this job, but you'll never be as good as you could be, right?
Love it.
And I mean, just think about all the stuff, Like, I've read tons of books. I don't know anything about risk management in high risk industries, but I can access hundreds of years of research and experience in 2 weeks by reading 3 books, right? If I want to know about, you know, survival strategies or how cops train in, you know, live fire training exercises and how that relates to live fire, yeah, I got 2 books on that.
Nice. Right?
Instead, you know, otherwise I'm just blundering around in the dark, hoping that I have an experience that teaches me the lesson that I need, right? When I could just browse some books and like, bam, I got it.
Right? I love that answer. I really do love that answer.
And the other thing too, is like, when it comes to books, like if I don't know the person, I struggle to recommend a book because it very much depends on where you are in your experience as a person, in your journey in the fire service, right? What I would recommend for a 2-year guy is going to be totally different than I would recommend for a 5-year guy who's looking to promote, or a 15-year guy, you might be a little burned out, or a chief who's thinking about starting a live fire program. Like, those are all going to be just vastly different things. So, I mean, I could recommend, I mean, I got a whole shelf of books I could recommend behind me.
But you're great. Hey, if you have one, if you had gun to your head, you had one, go for it.
It's been mentioned before. I'm going to say Deep Survival.
Okay. Right with Crush.
Well, because it's how you think, right? It's how you think, and nothing's more important than how you think. You can have all the skills in the world, but if you don't have the right mindset, you're going to crash and burn eventually. But if you have the right mindset, you'll figure out where you need to learn, and then you'll learn and fill your weaknesses.
Great, great, great. Absolutely love it. Let's get to the 5 questions for firefighters. It's my favorite part of the show. It is where I ask you 5 questions. The answers are 100% your opinion. There is no correct answer, and the points are arbitrary, and they're passed out by me with the help of the audience. So my main question is, are you ready for the next 5 questions for firefighters?
I am. Let's do it.
Beautiful.
As a joke, my goal was to try and not score, was to score low. Because you give out max, you're so generous with max points.
It's not that I'm generous. This is a misconception. This really is a misconception. I'm not generous. I'm actually a harsh master of passing out points. It's the fact that the guests are so good, it's almost impossible not to give max points week in, week out. It really is a very high bar that it's almost the guests are so good, it's almost expected. So that's the bar. But it's not. Please don't go for a golf score.
Okay.
Now, this is your 5 questions. You do with it what you will. What is the skill that has carried you through your fire service career?
I think it's a combination of like patience and persistence. It's allowed me to, you know, kind of see it. First, it allowed me to be patient with myself and with those around me to take the time necessary to like actually accomplish goals and look out ahead and see like, okay, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. How can I lay the groundwork? It's also allowed me to be patient with like accomplishing the live fire stuff that I wanted. Like, it took 3 years to accomplish one of the goals I wanted, just coming back, just light touch. And I think it's been so helpful because in the fire service, we're not like, we solve problems most of the time in 30 minutes or less. And a long problem might be like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And no. So we're just not trained to think long term. We see a problem and we come and we bang on the chief's desk and be like, how come we're not dealing with this? I'm sure you've never dealt with that. And people burn bridges, they make enemies, they get angry. And if you could just be patient and just kind of keep plugging along, little quiet conversation over here, a little research over there, and just keep coming back. You can just do so much.
Nice. Nice. I love patience. I love persistence. And most people usually take persistence and say, I'm so stubborn. But when you combine it with that patience, again, what I love about the answer is you really are describing that humility you were bringing up earlier about that key that Brian Crush asked. So for me, that was a great answer, and I will absolutely easily say max points on number 1. Number 2, It's job town. It's time. You're in route and responding. Think of the scene from Backdraft where he slaps the cassette tape into that tape deck. What song are you playing in route?
Oh, this is easy. So I'm the captain on Engine 28. Our name is the Devil Wagon. And so it's AC/DC. It's the Highway to Hell.
Highway to Hell.
I mean, come on. Listen to those lyrics. Like, I don't need reason. I don't need rhyme. Ain't nothing I'd rather do going down. It's party time. My friends are going to be there too. Like, that is exactly what I think and I feel every time I'm going to a fire. Like, and that, you know, that guitar and that drum, like, come on.
Is that the first time on Highway to Hell? I mean, I know we've had AC/DC before, but I thought it was Thunderstruck and Back in Black, but I'm not sure. Max points for AC/DC. Number three, coming at you. What is your favorite fire service tradition?
Pipes and drums.
Boom.
Like, hands down. Right? That sound. Right? There's nothing like it. It gives me goosebumps every time still. And in our department, we have a well-developed pipes and drums band. So they show up at a lot of stuff. So we get to hear it a lot and never get tired of it.
Love it, man. I'm telling you, just that warming, you know, when they're getting ready to start, I can just, that gives me chills, man. Yeah, Preston Lyon said it. Max points for pipes and drums. Easy max points for pipes and drums. Yeah, like you said, the chills. This one is on the clock. On the clock. We had to put it on the clock, but you get to put four people on your Mount Rushmore, the fire service.
Yeah.
Four people, no honorable mentions, no five, you get four, and you get 1 minute to do so. And go.
First off, Aaron Fields, but not for the reason most people say. It's because of some opportunities he gave me to go to Texas and observe his test burns with his cadre. Nice. And that changed my vision of what you could do with a building. Second is a guy named Brian Mayer. He's just a mentor and a friend, and his mindset around safety and live fire training and realism, that combination, it guides me to this day. I still ask, what would Brian do? It's Melissa Kennedy, another friend and mentor who's pushed me to be better than I thought I could be. And has also smacked me on the back of the head a few times when I needed it. Right, you know, I mean, just an amazing human being. And then the last is my mom. So my mom's the first firefighter I ever knew. She worked for 40 years for the Forest Service, did tons of wildland fire training. And when I ended up working for the Forest Service for a couple of summers, I went on a couple of one long wildland deployment. And she was my crew boss the whole time. 3 weeks traipsing around, digging line. Yeah, nice. It was amazing. Like, she's the toughest human being I've ever met. Hardest working to this day at 73, still going to CrossFit 4 days a week. Like,
wow.
Constant inspiration. Like, yeah, just, yeah.
Preston again said max points for mom. Great, great four. Great Mount Rushmore. Nice blend of big names and local. And of course, mom, man. How do you beat that? That's awesome, dude, to have that kind of influence in your life. Yeah, Dan Benner said, mom always gets max points. BC Mattson said, great people. No, great answer. Great answer. And the final question, which I'll be surprised if I'm wrong on this one, but we'll see. I've been surprised before. There is heavy fire and searchable space. Would you rather be assigned to the nozzle or first in on VES?
Well, I really want to know what you think it is, but I think I'm going to surprise some people, but it's VES.
Okay, you surprised me.
Yeah, well, it's because, look, like, the nozzle is the most important position at the fire. Let's be clear. Like, there's a reason every fire department has an engine, and a lot don't have trucks, right? You got to put the fire out to make everything better. But for me personally, like, we're talking about a residential environment, right? This is a risk, and I know I'm going to win on a nozzle, right? I've done that. Like, it's fun. Don't get me wrong, but it's not a challenge, right? And like, going ahead of the line, going above the fire, making those decisions, like, can I go? Can I not? Can I isolate this space? Can I find this person under like the most intense conditions, the mental acuity that requires, the decision-making, like that? Oh man, that's the best. Like, that's, Yeah, it's
I love it, dude.
And it, yeah, I mean, it's so challenging, right? You got no lifeline, but your experience and your mind and maybe a door, right? So that, yeah.
Brother, no, hey, easy max points on the end. And the thing I love, it's not the answer. You can go either way. What I love to hear is the reason for the answer. You had a beautiful, beautiful reason for your answer. And I love it, man. So all I can say is that officially gives you max points, 5 for 5. Make those grabs. As they said, we are here for them. Max points from Kyle Nelson. Jake Deal said, wow, bombs just went off here in Missouri. I'm hoping he's saying that because of your answer, not because there's bombs going off, I believe. Preston said, Kyle has left the chat. Michael Pike said max points for them. And David Pruitt said, you crushed it, my brother. Yeah. BC Mattson said, we are all here for them. We should all answer, make the grab. And that's the reason I love hearing the answer. I love hearing the answer and the reason behind it. So
but
I love
it. The grab's a lot easier when the fire's not burning anymore. Let's be clear. This is just what I want to do, not what's best for them. Best for them, flow and move to the fire.
No, there's no doubt about it. And that's why I love hearing the answer. That's why I was wrong. I figured you'd say, give me the knob, but I was wrong. And that officially, with those answers, makes it 242 scraps in the books. Ian Bennett, thank you for being with us this evening and spending the evening with us. If someone wants to get a hold of you for more info, how can they go about doing that?
The easiest would be just my email, westcoastfiretraining@outlook.com. You can go to the website. It's on there if you forget what it is. So westcoastfiretraining.com. You can reach out to me, Facebook, you know, West Coast Fire Training. That's a good way that folks reach out to. So, yeah, email or Facebook.
There you go. Beautiful. Housekeeping, go to firehousevigilance.com. The vigilantes, go join. $5 a month. We are on Patreon. We launched the Patreon today. So go become a part of it. It's amazing. If you have not watched the announcement, if you're in the vigilantes, I want to tell everybody, if you're in the vigilantes and you haven't seen the announcement video today, go check it out on the private Facebook page because it explains, it has all the details. I don't want to go into it right now. But one of the cool parts of being about vigilante is you get an invite to the after party. Sam will be posting the link for the scrap after party in the Facebook group. He'll be posting it in the Patreon. That's where the vigilantes show up and they get to bust the chops of the guest. So, and that's what's about to happen. And Ian has agreed to come and have his chops busted. The new book is out. Check it out. It's our, I don't know if anybody can actually see me holding up the book, but you, me, and our broken tools, me and my wife wrote a book on relationships. And I think it has valuable stuff if you want to have a long lasting relationship. Next week, the guest is Dan Shaw, followed by Scott Thompson, and then Rich Stack. How is that for a badass lineup? You will not want to miss these episodes as we keep 2024 rolling in style. Man, I want to say one thing about FDIC last week. It was unreal. It was chaotic whirlwind of time and chaos. And the vigilante meetup was out of this world. So thank you for showing up. Those who showed up, it was really, really cool. If you're going to be a part of the scrap after party, look for that link in the private group. I said all that. Please bring your thoughts. Audience, thank you for tuning in tonight. Thank you, A, for putting up with the issues this evening. Hopefully it was an anomaly. Hopefully it's not a usual thing. Ian, you were a trooper putting up with me and it. So thank you very much for everything.
All good.
Audience, thank you for tuning in live. Thank you for amazing questions. Thank you for being here because you are what makes the scrap magical. Remember, mutts don't scrap. I hope the tones stay silent unless it is burning. Everybody, stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening to the Weekly Scrap. Please subscribe and please share. We'll see you at the next episode.